Well, this evening we want to talk about prophecy and our future. I mean, as we read the news, I used to do newscasting. I was a disc jockey for a while, then I got into broadcast news, and I reported the Cuban Missile Crisis, and then a year later reported the death of President Kennedy. And as we look at news today, it's very hard not to come to a conclusion something is on the verge of happening. It's trying to happen. Well, it makes sense to me, since the Bible has already batted 1,000 in a lot of ways on a lot of prophetic issues that have already come true, it might not hurt to see if the Bible has something to say about the world in which we live. So let's go back to an April afternoon in Jerusalem. And Jesus and the disciples were there. They were leaving the temple really for the last time, because the next time Jesus would go back into that temple, he would be in shackles, he would be on trial for his life. It was that close to the crucifixion. And it was late afternoon, the sun was probably turning a deep orange, and the view just might have been magical. Now you think about that temple, the one that Herod helped to build. Been 4 decades and more in building, and the thing was made out of snowy white marble blocks. I mean, the Roman Empire could really produce beautiful stone buildings, and this was one of them. And up on the summit of the hill of Zion was this building that housed the Sanctus Sanctorum, Kodesh Kodeshim, the Holy of Holies. And this thing was made of white marble blocks, and out at the doorway, there were two enormous marble pillars. They spanned the doorway going into the Holy and Holy of Holies. And around these were twined grapevines made of hammered gold. These golden grapevines just wound around these pillars, almost like that was a divine dream. Israel, you know, had they really sensed the relationship the Lord wanted to have with them, they would have been clinging to him like those golden vines. And so here's this late afternoon sun turning a deep orange, and it hits those golden grapevines and just turns them into fiery color, and the whole temple is turning beautiful shades of orange. And here's 12 young Jewish guys walking with Jesus, and they're proud young Jewish fellows, and they just can't handle it. And you can almost see them kind of gently pull at Jesus' robe and point toward this gorgeous building, and in the vernacular they say, "So look already? Okay?" And what is Jesus' response? He says, "Don't spend too much time looking at those stone fellows, because they're not going to be here very long." And he wasn't kidding. 40 years later, General Titus of the Roman army would bring the 5th, 10th, 12th, and 15th legions out around that city, surround the city, throw a siege dike around it, so nobody got in, nobody got out. By the time his soldiers finally took that city, they set fire to the Temple Mount, and those golden grapevines began to melt and flow into the cracks of the stones, and that army tore that building apart looking for gold, and there wasn't one stone left on another. Just the way Jesus had said. Well, the disciples were in some way probably greatly deflated to hear Jesus say this whole thing's coming down. And you can almost see them walk silently out through, you know, down the 13 steps from the court of Israel down to the court of the women, another 13 steps down to the court of the Gentiles, out through that narrow little walkway that we probably now call a Via Dolorosa, out the eastern gate, across the Kidron Gorge, up a shallow hillside, into a place called Gethsemane, which just means place of the olive press. And they're sitting there maybe squinting into the sunset on that damp spring grass on the hillside. And they finally just can't hold it back. What Jesus has described sounds to them like the end of the world. And they say, "Lord, what will we see when it happens? How will we know when this stuff is going to begin to happen?" And Jesus responds, and evidently what he has to say is really important, because all three of the synoptic gospels, we're talking Matthew, Mark, and Luke, all three of them report what Jesus had to say. This was important enough to say three different ways. And Jesus' response was a checklist of things you look for, and when you see those beginning to happen, you know we're on the brink of something important. And with that checklist, Jesus gave some interesting Bible study advice. He said, read and understand the prophetic book of Daniel. Now, sometimes Christians today say, well, Old Testament, that's something we don't have to read anymore. Well, maybe not, but Jesus' advice was read and study the book of Daniel at least. And so we'll find that Daniel is an incredibly fascinating book. I mean, it contains a prophecy that actually foretells mathematically to the very year when Jesus would begin his ministry, when he'd be baptized to begin to preach. It foretells the very year he would be crucified. It foretells the very year the first Christian martyr would die. Three for three. This thing, by the time Stephen is stoned to death in Jerusalem, Daniel's prophecy is batting 1,000. It's three for three. It also proves with mathematical certainty Jesus came at the right time. So it's not surprising in Mark 1:15, when Jesus came to the Jordan River to be baptized, he said, the time is fulfilled. Well, he wasn't kidding. The time was fulfilled. It was Daniel's prophecy is being fulfilled. So Jesus said, you want to know what's happening at the end of time. You want to know what to look for. Study and understand the book of Daniel. So let's follow his good advice and take a look at Daniel chapter 12, verse 1. Daniel chapter 12, verse 1. And at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince which standeth for the children of thy people, and there shall be a what? Time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation. Daniel says the close of human history will be a time of real turmoil. And that's saying something. He's saying it's worse than anything in human history, and that is saying a mouthful. But Daniel 12:1 is kind of cryptic. It tells you something, but it uses very few words to say it. Now, when we get down to Jesus on the Mount of Olives with his disciples in Matthew 24 and Mark 13 and Luke 21, Jesus now, after telling us, read and understand Daniel, he begins to give us detail. Gives a checklist of things to look for. He says there will be confused people at the end of time. He says, watch out, the very brightest and best will be in a time in which even they could be confused. Don't let it happen to you. There will be false Christs, he said, and false prophets. That one really interests me these days because an awful lot's going on in our world today because a lot of people believe in a prophet. Jesus says, watch out, there will be false Christs and false prophets. Be careful, nobody deceives you. Then Jesus moves on to geopolitics. He says there are going to be angry nations. There's going to be turmoil. There will be war. There will be threatened war. This world will be tumultuous in terms of threatened hostilities. And he goes on to add another checklist on our item on the checklist. He says even nature will seem to turn strangely hostile. And he talks about earthquakes and famines. And that term earthquake, it means a lot. It's near and dear to somebody who lives in California. I well remember when we used to visit my relatives in Texas. And they'd say, you know, we got our tornadoes, but y'all got those earthquakes and we'll take our tornadoes any day. Well, guess what's happening now? The earth is quaking in Texas. Jesus says there will be strange new diseases called pestilence. Now, is anything here starting to sound familiar? Is this beginning to sound like what you hear on the evening news? What about something called Ebola? Strange new diseases that confuse and frighten people. But it gets even worse. Jesus then predicts a societal breakdown where even friends and family betray each other. And I'll give it to you from Mark 13. Mark does a very clear job of kind of recording Jesus' words on this one Beginning with verse 12, Jesus is speaking. He says, brother will betray brother, a father his child, children will rise up against parents and cause them to be put to death. Then he goes on to say, you will be hated of all people for my name's sake. In other words, a time of such stress that even families no longer hold together. Well, that leaves us with a question. If all of this stuff goes so bad, if the world just begins to decompress so badly that Jesus can describe it in those terms, then the question is, what would cause such a catastrophic global collapse of order such that even families fall apart? And for that, now we have to turn to the book of Revelation. Daniel's cryptic. He says it, but he says it in a very few words. Jesus goes into detail and adds a checklist of things to look for. And then Revelation paints word pictures that are so graphic, it's almost like being there. But to understand what Revelation describes, we have to understand Bible symbolism. There's a real risk about reading highly symbolic books like Revelation without understanding the symbolism that the Bible builds in. I well remember years ago there was a fine young pastor in Bakersfield, had a church that met every Sunday, and during the week he would get his people together in homes and would study a book written about Revelation. It was then very, very popular, written by a popular writer who obviously didn't understand Bible symbolism. And the pastor was saying, you know, the Bible predicts that Russia will invade Israel on horseback. And he said, here's the proof. And he opens up the book, and there is a picture with Russian writing on it showing a bunch of horsemen riding across the underbelly of southern Europe headed in the direction of Israel. He says, there's the proof. That's their plan. We got their picture. The only problem was the pastor couldn't read Russian. I could, because I used it in the military. What the picture said was, Pochta Konyi, Pony Express. So we have to be a little bit careful when we read highly symbolic prophecies that we understand Bible symbolism, or we can take it literally and make a huge mistake. So now let's turn to the book of Revelation, and we're going to kind of get the picture filled in from what Daniel told us and what Jesus told us. And we turn to Revelation chapter 13, verse 1. And John is standing on the sand of the sea. It's like he's just a few steps outside this tent, standing on the sand, on that coral-composed sand, looking out at the ocean. And he sees something coming out of the water. And let's give it to you in the words of Revelation 13:1. I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having seven heads and 10 horns. I mean, this is getting weird, isn't it? Seven heads and 10 horns, and on his horns 10 crowns, and on his heads the name of blasphemy. And right now I'm going to say once again, you're not going to get this unless you understand Bible symbolism. So let's unpack this verse, letting the Bible explain its symbolism for itself. In prophecy, a beast is not infrequently used to symbolize a powerful nation or empire or geopolitical force. Let me give you an example. The prophet Daniel was in vision, and in Daniel chapter 8, he sees animals. He sees a ram with those two curly horns, and way out to the west he sees a goat with one long horn, almost like a unicorn, and that goat just comes screaming across the desert toward the city in Babylon, where the Babylonian Empire, where Daniel was then. And he smites the ram, and the ram dies. And at that point, you could say, well, in the future, some big ram's going to hit some big goat, and the goat's going to die. But fortunately, Daniel had a visitor with him by the name of Gabriel. And folks, there is no better authority source this side of the throne. Gabriel is whom? He's the head created being in the entire cosmos. Lucifer used to be. Lucifer's been cast down. Gabriel took his place. And Daniel was honored to have that mighty head angel of heaven there in his room. And Gabriel unpacks the text and he explains it to him. And now in Daniel 8, 20 and 21, Gabriel explains to him that the ram represents something. It represents the nations of Media and Persia that kind of allied there in the area of Babylon. And the goat represents the nation of Greece. That's Alexander the Great coming with great speed from the west across the desert, and he hits the Medo-Persian Empire and it collapses, and Alexander the Great turns Greece into a world power. So the point I'm making here is that in the Bible, will use colorful animals to kind of illustrate nations and geopolitical forces. It's exactly what's happening here in the book of Revelation. So in Revelation 13, John sees this beast just covered with heads and horns. Horns are what? That's the way an animal enforces its will. And this thing is covered with horns. In other words, what John sees rising out in the distant future is a geopolitical force that will not take no for an answer. And notice something in Revelation 13, on the heads of that thing is written the name blasphemy, which suggests that this beast has some kind of religious overtone, because blasphemy is a anti-religious act. Okay, so John's standing by the sand of the sea, and this beast comes from where? Comes out of the water. Now we have another biblical symbol, and we can understand more about the prophecy. In the Bible, what does water represent? Water represents people. And we know that because in Revelation 17:15, John's angelic messenger says, "The waters which you saw are peoples, multitudes, nations." The Bible uses water to illustrate people, and I just am so enchanted by the clarity of biblical symbolism. Water is so much like people. You know, it can be very beautiful. Single drop of water catching sunlight is beautiful. The ocean out here on a calm day is beautiful. A waterfall is beautiful. But you let wind blow on water, and wind is the biblical symbol of strife, and what do you have? You get that wind circulating the wrong way, and you have a tropical depression, which then becomes a tropical storm, and I don't need to explain it further than that to people living in the Florida Keys. You know what a hurricane's like. I do too. As a naval officer, I've been in two of them. I've been in a typhoon in the Formosa Straits. I've been in a hurricane off the west coast of Mexico and the Gulf of Tehuantepec. Believe me, when you're at sea, those are not habit-forming. So when wind blows on water, when strife blows on people, storms result. By the way, Revelation 7 foretells a time in which angels will be holding back winds of strife to give the world a little more time to get ready for the coming of Jesus. So, this beast comes out of water, which means it comes out of the population of the world. All right. Now it's got seven heads and ten horns, and what, pray tell, does that mean? Well, what does ten mean? In the Bible, ten is oftentimes used as a symbol of kind of completion, global completion. For example, when the Lord wanted to tell an entire planet rules to live by, to stay out of trouble and to get along with each other, how many commandments did he give us? Ten. In the Bible, there were ten patriarchs before the flood. There were ten patriarchs after the flood. In Daniel 2, there is this picture of human history from the time of Babylon all the way down to the coming of Christ, and it takes the form of a statue of a man made of various metals. But down in the very end of human history, it portrays the world as like ten toes of that statue made of iron and clay. In other words, very unstable, very, very weak. Ten toes, I think, representing the entire nations of the world. So ten biblically can describe something that is global, Now you have 10 horns with 10 crowns. What does a crown represent? That's a governmental leader, isn't it? A king or a president or a premier. What I think we're seeing here with those 10 horns and 10 crowns are 10 kings, in other words, all the nations of the world. Now, is my supposition correct? Well, let's let the Bible explain itself. Go to Revelation 17, verse 7. Once again, John's angel is speaking. He's getting direct help from an angel messenger from the throne of God. And John's angel said, in verse 7 of Revelation 17, I will tell you the mystery of the woman and the beast that carries her, which has 7 heads and 10 horns. The 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings. In other words, all the governments of the world, which have received no kingdom as yet. John, you're at the end of the first century AD. This is not for your time. This is way downstream in time. This will happen way downstream from you. It says they have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. The Greek word there for hour is hora, which doesn't mean necessarily a literal hour, just a very short, indeterminate period of time. Fortunately, this time of trouble the Bible predicts doesn't last long. Praise God for that. Lasts long enough to demonstrate to the entire universe that sin is very dangerous, very self-destructive. Don't ever mess with it again. So, they receive authority as kings with a beast 1 hour. Now look at verse 13. Revelation 17, verse 13. These are of what? Okay, the jury's still awake out there. I'm glad to hear it. These are of one mind. In other words, they all think alike. They've all agreed. Now put it all together. If 10 is a biblical symbol for everything all over the world, if all 10 kings, in other words, if all the nations of the world come together for a brief period of time and have one mind, they're all thinking the same thing, what's a word you could use for that? The word is globalism. Are you following me? There is a brief period of globalism at the end of time. 10. Everything, everywhere, global totality. Now let's tie up one more of those numbers that are used symbolically here. What about the 7 heads? 7 heads are 7 mountains. In Revelation 17, verse 9, John's angelic messenger said, the 7 heads are 7 mountaintops. Now think about this. This earth has 7 continents. Asia, Africa, North America, South America, Europe, Australia, and Antarctica. Is there a possibility, and every one of those continents, every island, these keys we're on right now are just mountain hills, just hills sticking up out of the ocean. Every landmass on earth is a mountaintop, so to speak, rising above the ocean. Is there a possibility the Bible, in every way you can imagine it, from the number 10, meaning everything everywhere, all the kings of the earth, also says all 7 landmasses of the earth, everything on earth, comes together in this end time beast which you are seeing? In some far off future that hadn't arrived yet in John's first century, something was going to happen. For a brief period of time, all nations of the earth would actually agree and they would give their authority and an agreement to something monstrous. The question is, when this globalism happens, and it's prophetically predicted to happen, will a united world be on the right side or the wrong side of a cosmic war? Well, let's let the Bible tell us, because what I say shouldn't matter much to you. What the Bible says should. Go back now to the rest of Revelation 17:13. They will give their power and authority to the beast. You following me? Verse 14, these 10 kings, these 7 mountaintops, these worldwide landmasses, every power on earth, verse 14, will make war with the whom? With the Lamb. Who's the Lamb? In the Bible, that's Jesus. Now, does that put them on the right side or the wrong side of a cosmic war? One might ask, well, you know, Jesus is just a little hard to get to, you know. He's out there somewhere in a place called heaven. We haven't lifted any space vehicle anywhere near there yet. So how do you make war on Jesus? And my response is, that's real simple. You make war on his followers on this earth. That's how you hurt him. Now, with that in mind, let's go back to Jesus' warning in Mark 13, verses 12 and 13. Now the brother shall betray the brother to death, and the father the son, and the children shall rise up against their parents, and ye shall be hated of all men for my name's sake. In other words, those who really love the Lord and follow him are misunderstood by an angry world. And what is one of the mechanisms that the world tries to use to get these nonconformist Jesus-following believers into line? Well, you find that in Revelation 13:16. It's an economic embargo. What does Revelation 13:16 say? And he causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark, and that none might do what? Buy or sell. That's an embargo. Now, when John could foresee in AD 95, the very thing we do today to bring the non-conforming nation or person into line, that tells me his pen was dipped in the right kind of ink. Prophecy in the Bible is uncannily successful in foretelling the future. No man might buy or sell, save he that had the mark, the name, or the number. All right. What have we said? The Bible predicts a time, in Daniel's words, of trouble worse than anything in human history. Jesus said it will go so far that even the family structure will no longer necessarily hold together. Revelation describes a frightened world going into a kind of a primitive herding instinct in which the nonconformist is feared and embargoed out of the marketplace. Now, what could cause that kind of catastrophic global unity? My response is an ugly four-letter word called fear. You think about it. You get people good and scared, and liberty goes overboard like Jonah. Let me give you some examples. During the Civil War, President Lincoln abolished the writ of habeas corpus. Just said it ain't going to happen, not as long as this war is going on. The writ of habeas corpus is the most powerful weapon an average individual citizen has against a powerful government. You're wrongly held by government, you can go and find a federal judge, and with a writ of habeas corpus, that single man or woman in a black gown can challenge the entire collective might of the U.S. government and set you free. President Lincoln abolished that during the Civil War. Why? Because he was frightened. This union was threatening to come apart. During World War II, what happened? President Franklin Roosevelt took his pen and signed Executive Order 9066, which did what? Imprisoned loyal Japanese Americans, because we were frightened of anybody that looked like the Japanese after Pearl Harbor. At the start of the 20th century, a black man by the name of Homer Plessy bought a railroad ticket tried to use it was tried for a crime, and the Supreme Court of the United States said separate but equals okay. Why? Because they were frightened. Okay? In every instance where we bend the magnificence of our Constitution, we do it out of fear. Now we're ready to talk about the world we live in. We've tried, first of all, to set a little framework up of prophecy to see what the Bible says will happen. Now let's talk about just three of the many global issues that we face today and see, as we progress in discussing these, see if they seem to make sense for you against the prophetic framework we've talked about. A frightened world coalescing into a panic unity that's on the wrong side of the cosmic war. Three major global issues. The first one that I want to talk about is the economy. Revelation 18 has some interesting predictions about a world in which the economy has collapsed. Let me read it to you here, starting with verse 11. And the merchants of the world will weep and mourn, for no one buys their merchandise anymore. Gold and silver, precious stones, every kind of object. All the things which are rich and splendid have gone. And then goes on to say the merchants stand at a distance saying, alas, for in 1 hour so great riches came to nothing. Greek word there once again is horab, very short, indeterminate period of time. Bible seems to suggest at the end of time there's some sort of collective massive economic collapse. Evidently it has trade implications because it describes shipmasters, those who trade by sea. Says every shipmaster and as many as trade by sea stood at a distance wailing, alas, for in 1 hour she is made desolate. What happens at the end of time happens fast. It's 1 hour. It's that brief indeterminate period of time in the Greek word horah. Now compare that with the book of James. The brother of Jesus wrote a fascinating book. And in the fifth chapter of the book of James, beginning with the first verse, he says, come now, you rich, weep and howl. Your riches are corrupted, your garments are moth-eaten, your gold and silver are corroded. And some translations use the word rusted. Your gold and silver have rusted. Now, what is wrong with James' prediction? This stuff doesn't rust. Gold will yield to almost nothing. You have to combine two very powerful laboratory-grade acids to even get it to react with gold. We used to coat our satellites early on back in the 50s with gold because we didn't know what was out there, and we figured gold is so non-reactive, whatever is out there that might be bad can't attack gold. Now, silver, you housewives know, will get kind of a little coating on it, but you can wipe it off with a bit of silver polish and it goes right back to silver. So these things that James is talking about don't rust, and yet he's describing a time, and Jesus describes a time in which gold and silver seem to rust. Just to make clear, when James is predicting this will happen, he talks about accumulating wealth in the last days. So it's an end time prophecy. Well, Jesus also uses a metaphor of rust. He said, lay not up for yourself treasures upon the earth where moth and rust corrupt and where thieves break through and steal. Now, Jesus not only uses James's interesting analogy of rust, he talks about thievery. And think about this. Does a thief always have to be a bad guy with a mask over his eyes and a crowbar gently opening your bedroom window? Or could a thief be a governmental policy that borrows money it knows can never be repaid, and in so doing, erodes the value of what you've saved? Could that be a thief? Well, with that in mind, let's talk about us today. Today, America owes $18 trillion, and we're pumping that up at the rate of about $2.5 billion a day. And to get an idea of just how much that is, think about what $1 trillion looks like. $1 trillion is a National League football stadium filled 83 feet deep in dollar bills. That's $1 trillion, which is more than I got on me at the moment. Now, we've got 18 NFL football stadiums full of borrowed dollar bills. I mean, we're talking MetLife, Cowboy Stadium, Mile High, Sun Life, Candlestick Park, the Georgia Dome, Heinz Field, Oakland Coliseum, and Qualcomm, and we still got 9 to go. Filled, absolutely filled with borrowed dollar bills. How are we ever going to deal with that kind of national debt? Well, there are three choices that I'm able to find. I'm a tax attorney. I represent taxpayers. I don't represent the IRS. And there are three choices I can see, the first one of which oftentimes is the first thing that politicians think of, and that is, well, we're just going to have to raise taxes. Problem with that is that if we raise taxes to the point where every wealthy person in the country paid 100% in taxes, we would probably run the government for only a relatively few short weeks and we'd be borrowing again. It's that extreme. The other probability is we take that much money out of the private sector and there simply is no more money to run business and then the jobs disappear. So raising taxes is an attractive thing to the political mind, but it doesn't necessarily lead you where you need to go. There's a second possibility, and that is this. Uncle Sam simply pulls one of these out and goes to the teller's window at the People's Bank of China and says, we're a little short on cash. We're good for this. We need to borrow a little more money, either at the Bank of China or in the Persian Gulf. That's where we've done a lot of our borrowing recently. That will work until an embarrassed teller at the teller's window of the People's Bank of China says, very sorry, but your credit card is declined. Okay? What do you do then? You're aware that Timothy Geithner went over to the PR of the Public People's Republic of China, spoke to an auditorium full of students, and he assured them, your investments are perfectly safe with us, and they howled with laughter. Why? Because we can't sustain where we're headed now. So if we can't raise taxes and pay the bill, and if we can't borrow our way out of the problem, what else might we be able to do to cope with this 18 football stadiums full of borrowed dollar bills? Well, let me show you if I can get it out of here. Let me show you what we might do. Here's another option. Now, these are the real deal. I didn't create these on the office copy machine. I got these from the Bureau of Engraving and Printing. You can just start printing money. That is what sovereign governments typically wind up doing. Well, are there any downsides to that? Let me tell you the story about Germany after World War I. Victorious Western allies imposed on Germany some very, very heavy reparations that they required Germany to pay. And the German economy was just shattered because of World War I. It was in terrible shape. And so finally the Reichstag said, well, the only thing we can do is print marks. That's all we have left to do is print marks. So they started printing them. And in 1919, when they started that, you could get 12 marks for a dollar. Okay? 2 years later, $1 would buy 263 marks. 2 years after that, $1 would buy 4.6 million marks. And by Christmas of 1924, $1 would buy 4.2 trillion marks. Now, here's what happens when a country prints more money than it really can afford to print. and the money gets to be worthless. Here is a $1 million mark note from Germany back there in the 20s. Notice something. There's no printing on the other side. It wasn't worth the ink. 1 million marks, and they only printed it on one side. And when I showed this to a German audience a few weeks ago when I was over speaking there, there were some knowing smiles on the faces of some of the older people. When you print money and debase your currency, here's what happens. Let me show you a modern example of that from the African nation of Zimbabwe. I've got here a bill on the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe for $100 trillion. I've got 20 of them. These were purchased for 15 cents. Now, the sad thing is Zimbabwe was a wealthy country with a wealth of resources and a wealth of human talent. Guess what happened? Some really smart people from the International Monetary Fund decided to go in there and change everything Zimbabwe was doing. They started redistributing wealth. They started reordering their financial structure. Pretty soon the agricultural economy broke down. A nation that had fed itself with food to spare was now importing food. There was catastrophic unemployment. They began printing money to finance a war. Oh, by the way, isn't that what we're doing too? Zimbabwe was printing money to finance a war, and then the awfulest thing that can happen to a monetary system happened in that African nation. The people just lost confidence in their money. Now, let me give you an example of how that can go. I've got here in my hand some examples of U.S. money. There is a $10 bill. You won't recognize it because you probably have never seen one of these things or you haven't seen it recently. Notice on the back of it, the color ink is gold. You know why? This thing says, this certifies there is on deposit with the Treasury of the United States $10 in gold payable to the bearer on demand. This thing could be traded basically for this. Well, we went off the gold standard. We went on the silver standard. And here's one that's kind of interesting. This one is a little more what we're used to seeing these days. This one says silver certificate. This certifies there's on deposit in the Treasury of the United States $5 in silver payable to the bearer on demand. So if you wanted to, you could take this to the bank and you could get $5 worth of this stuff. Well, we went off that standard as well. Now I'm holding a current $5 bill. Guess what it says? Federal Reserve Note. Which means what? This is an IOU. It ain't backed by gold. It ain't backed by silver. It's backed by what? Our collective confidence that this will be honored. Now, pray God something bad doesn't happen to America like happened to Zimbabwe. But may I respectfully suggest that there was a time when Zimbabwean citizens held these and believed they were good. What happens when you debase a nation's currency is you lead that nation to the ultimate kind of fear that can produce somebody by the name of Adolf Hitler. By the way, you're aware that wasn't his real name. He picked that name because he thought it sounded good. His real name was Schicklgruber. I'm serious. And he evidently realized that Heil Schicklgruber just did not ring, so he changed his name to Hitler. And good people. There are no better people on earth than the German people. They have given us so much in the way of culture and engineering genius, you know. It is from the Germans we developed our jet fighters after World War II. They're wonderful people, but you get people frightened enough and they make huge mistakes. And so what I'm getting at is that economically, we're really flying into a box canyon. I don't see a really good end to this thing, nor does Revelation. And so from the standpoint of the economic picture we're looking at today, increasingly, I become convinced, you know, the good book just may have been on to something when they said there will come a time when the real answer to your problem is straight up. Let's talk about physical threats. We've talked about the economy. Let's talk about physical threats. Daniel 12 suggests there will be some real trouble at the end of time. Jesus suggests it too, wars, rumors of wars and so forth, enough to get people so frightened they finally say, well, we're going to have to pull together into some kind of global unity or we're toast. Let's talk about the physical threats we see today that could get people frightened enough to make war with the Lamb. Daniel 12 says there will be a time of trouble worse than anything people had ever seen. In Luke 21, Jesus, in some of the more modern translations, says men will faint with terror at the thought of what's happening to the world. Revelation 11:18 puts it this way, the nations were angry and thy wrath is come and the time of the dead that they should be judged and that thou shouldest destroy them which destroy the earth. End of quote. Those aren't my words, those are John the Revelator's words. He's getting that from a heavenly messenger. Apparently, when the Lord comes, when the Advent occurs, when Jesus reappears, it's a rescue mission because humanity is in the process of destroying this fragile little planet. Now, let's compare those prophecies with the world we live in. Let me give you just a couple of examples. I mean, obviously, we know that there are developed nations that are nuclear capable. We're talking U.S., Russia, Europe, China. These potential fireballs are in the hands of people who are both responsible and less responsible. The one that worries me a little bit now is the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists has estimated that Pakistan has from 70 to 90 deliverable nuclear weapons. U.S. intelligence puts that at around 100. Nobody's totally sure, but I do know that Brigadier General Khan, a Pakistani Army Brigadier General, said that Pakistan had from 80 to 120 what he called genuine warheads, and I have no reason to doubt him. The U.S. says they've got at least 100. Now, what's worrisome is that India next door is also nuclear capable, and those two nations just despise each other. And it has been said that even a regional nuclear conflict, God forbid, between India and Pakistan would release so much debris in the air, there would be catastrophic crop failures and probably a couple of billion people could die just from lack of food. So our world is not particularly user-friendly, but that isn't the end of the story. Our latest intelligence is that Saudi Arabia, with its enormous oil wealth and its great fear of Iran, has purchased Pakistani nuclear weapons and delivery systems. We're talking missiles to carry these things. The Saudi king, before he passed away, had warned, I think two or three years ago, that if Iran goes nuclear, we will have nuclear weapons. They're paid for. We will take delivery. British intelligence and the BBC has also reported these stories. So, like when I was back in the news business, you know, we ferret out from as many different sources as we can what we can learn, the credibility of those various sources, and try to put a story together. And it seems very evident to me that Saudi Arabia is scared to death of a nuclear Iran. We're headed there at flank speed. They will have a nuclear weapon soon. It doesn't appear that we're going to do anything to stop them. What we do know from satellite photography is that Saudi Arabia has two missile launching stations. They're the kind that launch on rails because they're not intercontinental. They don't have to go that far. The Middle East isn't that big. Some of those rails are pointed toward Israel. The rest of them are pointed toward Iran. in Saudi have told us, basically, if Iran goes nuclear, so do we, and we're going to mount those weapons, and we're going to use them if we have to. Another thing that worries me a little bit is some of the bellicose rhetoric out of Iran about, you know, taking Israel out even if it costs us a million lives. Israel has a contingency plan for that. It's called the Samson plan. What happened to Samson? Samson, that Israeli giant, imprisoned by the Philistines, pulled down that temple on himself. He died in the rubble, but he killed the Philistines as well. Israel's Samson plan is only two bombs would be needed to be an existential threat for Israel. One hits Jerusalem, one hits Tel Aviv, the nation's gone. And if that happens, they have some German-built, very quiet, very capable submarines in the Mediterranean and closer to the Gulf near Iran. Those things can launch nuclear weapons. Israel's plan is if we go, so do they. And the whole Middle East goes up in smoke. Now, I'm not predicting that will happen. I pray God it does not. This world, as imperfect as it is, deserves a better end than that. But Revelation does warn that the time of the end is coming and the Lord comes to destroy those who destroy the earth. Now, all I'm saying is, as we watch the news, we're in a fool's paradise if we don't get concerned. At least get concerned enough to turn off the trash that comes out of Hollywood, my hometown, and get back into the Word of God. That's where we need to be. And you know, the Lord has been so good to us that even if we can't get interested in anything that doesn't come on a TV screen, you can put the Bible there now. We got these wonderful Bible computer programs that with a click of a mouse, you can move from one version to another. You can go to interlinear versions. You can get commentaries. You get Bible maps. You can get Vines, Englishmans. You can get the concordances that link all of these biblical words together. You can do your own research. And it just gets so fascinating that Hollywood can't compete with it. I'm serious. Bible research is really fascinating once you begin to do it right. So anyway, 20 years ago when we were writing the euphoria of having won the Cold War, I repeatedly warned audiences that the day would come we would long for the rationality of our old Soviet enemies. Because the devout communists had nothing but this life. So as bellicose as they could be, as much as they like to rattle sabers, when push came to shove, and we declared a quarantine of Cuba, and it looked like we were nose to nose, Khrushchev backed down. Finally, just went ballistic in Lenin's office in Moscow, as I understand it. Khrushchev said, get me a car and drive me to the nearest radio station. Well, comrade Premier, what station? I don't care what station. Get me to a radio station. They did. He walked in. The announcer got off the desk. They opened the mic and Khrushchev broadcast his capitulation in the clear to the world, hoping somebody in the West would hear it. That's how close we came. I could spend the rest of the evening telling you stories about the Cuban Missile Crisis. We're kind of close to it here, but suffice it to say, the old communist adversary at least was a rational enemy. Compare that with somebody who expects the end of the world to go up in a fiery conflagration so the hidden imam can appear, and you got a very different world. So physical dangers in this world. Let me go, as we close, to one other item that I think ought to be of concern to all of us. We've talked about the economy and how it seems to be kind of drifting into a modality that's prophetically predicted. We've talked about the physical dangers in our world. Now let's talk about our societal values. The secular drift of our society. Something's going wrong everywhere you look. From court decisions to administrative decisions, even to the way the evening news is sometimes presented. The values that most of us have always believed in are just going through our fingers like sand. Think about the trash that passes for entertainment. We too willingly accept into our homes. I'm talking the language and the violence and the promiscuity that we let into our homes and babysit our kids or grandkids. We are watching a real moral collapse in this country. I've practiced in downtown L.A. for big national firms. The language I have heard from ladies in law offices is the kind of stuff I used to hear from sailors on the quarterdeck of a warship. Kind of reminds me of the old gentleman who got on the elevator. He was really old school. He was wearing his hat. Two young women came on the elevator. He took his hat off. There were ladies present. The elevator stopped at every floor, and pretty soon one of those young women said, "Blankety blank this, blankety blank, elevator stop." And the old man didn't say anything, just put his hat back on his head. Think about the disappearance of common courtesy, the disappearance of the traditional home. I mean, what we see doesn't reflect the values most of us assumed were the ones we wanted. I'm talking traditional family, hard work, honesty, decent language, common courtesy. More and more, the unwelcome thought steals into our minds, something's happening. The society and the country that I love, something's wrong. And it all brings to mind a prediction made by Jesus. He said in Luke 17, "As it was in the days of Lot." Why did Jesus pick Lot? Well, where did Lot live? Place called Sodom. And the problem is the guys in Sodom had one major thing on their minds. It was an obsession. It was an obsession with honesty, decency, hard work, or the traditional family. Their obsession was so intense that even when supernaturally struck blind, they couldn't give it up. They had only one thing on their minds, and it wasn't Lot's daughters. And there came a time when even heaven had enough. Do we hear echoes of Sodom today? What about the traditional family? You know, where kids once heard truths, read every evening from the Bible by a mom and a dad. That's a heavy lifter, and that brings back memories to my mind when I used to hear those flying overhead in a war zone. Kids would hear truths read from the Bible by a mom and a dad. And they went to church every week, and they learned to work and treat elders with respect and say yes, sir, and no, ma'am, and to count honest change at the cash register. And the question we have to ask ourselves is, what's happening to our society? Pressures everywhere one looks, there are pressures. There are converging lines of force as if this world is being herded by circumstances into a mindset where finally a confused and frightened world is able to make the kind of mistakes foretold in Revelation 13 and 17. Now that would be the bad news. What I love about the Bible is it's frank. It's honest. It tells you the dangers out there. But why wouldn't you want to know them? Why wouldn't you want to go out here in the ocean around these keys with a good chart telling you where the danger was? But not only does the Bible tell us where the problems may be, it also tells us how you avoid them. And it tells us how the story ends. Now, Revelation 17 earlier, we were talking about a confused and frightened world uniting into a brief period of globalism. And verse 14 says, "These shall make war with the Lamb." But the verse doesn't end there. It goes on to say, "And the Lamb shall overcome." This war is not lost. Heaven wins it. Revelation puts it this way. Jesus actually puts it these way in his own words to John. "Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee a crown of life." My suggestion is everything we see in the news that other people may have the right to worry about, we don't have the right to be scared because we know how the story ends and we know how to get through the reefs out into clear water. And the way off this world, more and more, is straight up. Now, let me close by saying that we've talked about some of the Bible prophecies and world events that we're living with, but the Bible doesn't just tell us about the problems we face, it gives us a pattern to follow to get through them. And tomorrow morning, our topic is going to be heaven's final message to an end-time world. We've talked a lot from Revelation 13 tonight about world, geopolitical problems in the world. Revelation 14 is a really neat chapter because it starts with the war over and the redeemed, the rescued hostages from earth are on the sea of glass, their home, and the war is over. And then 6 verses later, it gives us a clear picture of how they got there. There's a way through. God's end time people have a heaven ordained plan to survive the mess this world is going to make of itself. And that's what we're going to talk about tomorrow.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.